So it's going to be an ad hoc series of teaching on common questions which people ask, particularly focusing in on common questions which Muslims ask. And probably there are two big questions which I get asked a lot. And one is about, has the Bible been corrupted? And the other one is about who is Jesus and who is God? And so this week we're going to zone in on the first of those questions about who, has the Bible been corrupted? And then we'll come back to the other one. That I particularly wanted to look at this Bible passage as our jumping off point to God's grace and Christ's grace. Begins. Now, who will want to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if you suffer for doing what is right, God will reward you for it. So don't worry or be afraid of their threats. Instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks about your hope as a believer, always be ready to explain it. But do this in a gentle and respectful way. Keep your conscience clear. Then, if people speak against you, they will be ashamed when they see what a good life you live, because you belong to Christ. Remember, it is better to suffer for doing good, if that is what God wants, than to suffer for doing wrong. And this passage has some great advice to us as we're reaching out to others. It tells us to be eager to do good. We want to be people who are known as being kind and generous and loving, who are involved in their community, just like John was saying, is going to be involved in running this new community centre. So people are like, oh no, he's being eager to do good. Because that is like a beautiful frame around the picture which we're going to paint then when we tell people about Jesus. So we're going to really offset that picture well with having a good lifestyle. But as you guys undoubtedly know from experience, as you go out to tell people about Jesus, in our culture, just like it was in the ancient Roman culture, there is a bit of pushback. And not everyone you meet is going to be eager to hear about Jesus. And that sometimes they will respond to us with hostilities and threats and bullying, and people will say mean things to us. And the encouragement is, that's not new. That's always been part of the Christian life. And that Peter's encouragement to the Christians he was writing to is in that place. We don't let the threats and the worries and the fear dictate what we do. We come back to focus on Jesus. We come back and worship him. And we try and love him far more than we're afraid of anything else. And that love of Christ, it fills up our hearts and it keeps the other stuff at bay. We need to make that our priority. And Peter goes on to give this famous verse about being ready to answer whatever questions you get, but with gentleness. And so we don't want to get into eye-poking with people, or like, you're right, you're wrong and I'm right, and we want to build rapport and good relationships with people, but we want to be ready to give good answers to their questions. And particularly, we want to be ready to give answers with evidence. You know, we want to have an explanation. That when the apostles are called on in the book of Acts to explain their faith, they appeal to both their experience, but they also appeal to the Bible, they appeal to well-known authors in the period and the time, they call for sorts of evidence which will be compelling to the audience which they're addressing. So we want to think about who are we talking to, and then we want to be able to pull across evidence which is going to be compelling to that group of people. Great, can I have the next slide? And so this is one of the first pieces of evidence I love to talk about with people, and it's from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the common kind of Muslim attack is often that the Bible has been corrupted and that it's been changed over time. And so they would look at it and go, it was originally, it was good, but now it's not good, right? And so what this slide and the next slide will show you is you can do is you can take the very oldest kind of manuscript evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were written hundreds of years before the coming of Christ, and at the time when the Romans invade after the life of Jesus in around 70 AD, that a group of Jews from the Essenes felt this was the end of the world. So they take these precious scrolls which they have, and they put them in a cave in the desert, and then those scrolls live there safely all the way through to the 20th century. And so by going back to these scrolls, which are from before the time of Jesus, we can do an experiment to find out if it's true that the Bible has been changed. Because if it has been changed, those really old scrolls would be different from the modern scrolls which we've received and which we have down today in our Bibles. And so to try and do that experiment, what we have here is Isaiah 9. I picked Isaiah 9 because in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the book of Isaiah happens to be very well preserved. It's a beautiful copy that's got all of the verses there. Very good archaeological text. I chose Isaiah 9 in particular because in this is the chapter which will tell us that one day a child will be given to us, and that child will be called Almighty God, Wonderful Counselor. And so it points to this point. This is the sort of verse which you'd have to change if you wanted to introduce the concept of Christianity. So the way these slides work is that you've got the red with a line through. If you have something in the most ancient one which has been dropped, you have red with underlined if something has been added. Everything which is in yellow is identical between both manuscripts, and anything in green, it's basically identical but with slight spelling variants. I apologise to people at the back if you can't quite see. I wasn't quite sure what font size I needed.
Is it the green?
Oh, sorry. But the biggest change which you find in this whole chapter is originally there was, but there shall be no more in this very ancient manuscript. And then in the handed down one manuscript, it says they will cease from, which basically says the same thing in slightly different words. Can I get on to the next slide? When we get to the key verse, it says, his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase and his government and of his peace there shall be no end, on David's throne and on his kingdom to establish it. We lose an end to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time on, even forever. And the and are single letters in the Hebrew manuscript. So what you see there is it's basically completely identical. There's absolutely no evidence that it's been changed at all. And if you were to do this comparative with any other ancient manuscript, you would be amazed to find it this well preserved. But this key concept that God would come in person to set the world right, absolutely the same. Next slide, please. The second piece of evidence is to compare and look at the number of manuscripts and the quality of manuscripts we have for the New Testament comparative to what we have for other ancient documents. And so here on the far side, we've got Pliny, Herodotus, Suetonius, Thucydides, and these are famous Greek or Roman historians, and they form the basis of everything which we know about the ancient world. They're the key texts. And for these key texts, which are almost universally accepted as being reliable historical sources, there is normally around 1,000 years from between when those texts were originally written and the oldest surviving manuscript of them. But despite that 1,000-year time gap, they are accepted. In terms of numbers of manuscripts for them, we normally have around 10. Like, it depends a little bit on which one you have, but on average, about 10 or so manuscripts. And that's doing pretty good. My old classics teacher said, if you took one manuscript of every document we have for the ancient world and put it into a cardboard box, you'd be able to shake the cardboard box and hear them moving around. You know that we often have to deal with a very small number of documents to get a lot of information. And if you go to the most famous book in the Greco-Roman world, the Iliad by Homer, which is an epic poem, and that is the thing which the Greeks just loved, we have a whopping 643 copies and a 500-year time gap. That is like the best book we have outside of the Bible. And if you look at the accuracy between those manuscripts, they're about 95% accurate. Now, if you go to the New Testament and do the same thing, you have less than 100 years between when it's written and the oldest manuscript. You've got nearly 6,000 manuscripts, which is almost 10 times what you had for the Iliad, which is incredible. Like the amount of historical confidence you can have in a document when you have that many manuscripts in that short a time span, it surpasses anything else in the same time period. When you look at the accuracy and the compare the manuscripts together, you find they're 99.5% accurate, which dwarfs the accuracy. It's much more accurate than it would have been for the Iliad. So what you see there is that we have a confidence that this text has been carefully preserved. Once again, absolutely no evidence that it's been changed. If someone had changed it, it would become quickly apparent because the manuscripts wouldn't be the same. Okay, next slide, please. When you go to the details of the New Testament, you find that the New Testament authors are experts on the first century. So occasionally you get someone like a Dan Brown kind of character, and he comes along and he says, well, these stories are all very interesting, but really they were written much later. Someone told me the other day they knew a church leader, and he was like, well, yeah, well, all those miracles, they were added in right later on by other people to make it look good. And you go, well, if that's the case, then they did a remarkably good job of it. So let me tell you about some of the details. So there's a famous story in John's Gospel set at the pool of Bethsaida, where Jesus finds a man waiting to go into the pool to be healed, but he heals him because he's too lame to ever make it to the pool in time. And John tells us a little detail about the pool. He says there are five covered colonnades there. And if you go back to read the atheist writings of the 18th and 19th century, people are like, this story is totally fictitious. It's a made-up story, they would say. And they would say that no place of the Pool of Bethsaida ever existed. But to their embarrassment, in the 20th century, some people came along, they excavated Jerusalem, and they found the Pool of Bethsaida. And they found that it did indeed exist, and it did indeed have five covered colonnades, just like John had said. Now the thing is, the Pool of Bethsaida was destroyed in 70 AD. So anyone writing after 70 AD would have a real difficulty knowing that there were exactly five covered colonnades there. It's not recorded in any other source. You know, the only way to know it would have been to be in Jerusalem in the first century and to have seen it yourself. So someone coming later on making up that story wouldn't be able to get the details right. When it comes to the names in the New Testament, we find that they're also very accurate. So you can go to historical writings from the first century and work out what sort of names people were commonly called. You can go to what's called bone boxes, which are kind of tombstone, a box which you would put burial remains in and then leave them once the bodies have decayed. And that's how the Jews often would dispose of their dead in the first century. So if you go and look at these bone boxes, you can work out what sort of names are men called and what sort of names are women called. And you can work out what the ratios of those different names were. Now, just as an experiment, if I told you, you've got to set a story in 18th century France, and I would like you to pick some French names to go into it, could you think of some good French names of 18th century France?
Jean-Pierre.
Jean-Pierre. Very good. Any other names?
Jacques.
Okay. So could you get the ratio of Jean-Pierre's to Jacques? Correct. Like that would be really hard, right? And so what you find when we come to the New Testament writers is not only do they know the common names, they get the ratio of the common names to the uncommon names correct. So the two most common men's names in the New Testament are Simon and Joseph. And they make up 18.2% of the names you encounter in the Gospels. If you go to the historical record, it's 15.6. Now the chances of you being able to guess the percentage of people called Simon and Joseph and get them at exactly the right ratios in your story, if you were making it up, are not high. If you go to the 9 most common men's name, they make 40.3% of the names which you occur in the Gospels. In the historical record, they make up 41.5%. Once again, I would find it incredible. Like, you would have to be a forger of the highest caliber to be able to retrospectively do that hundreds of years later. Like, it would be bordering upon impossible by statistical chance to get that right. Next slide, please. When we look at the names, they get know which names are common and which ones aren't. So this is a passage from Matthew's Gospel. And what we find is for common names like Simon, we're given a clarification. This is Simon Peter, or it's Simon the Zealot. This is Matthew the tax collector. This is Judas Iscariot, because those are common names. I put here in red the nature, the ranking of the name. So one tells you it's the number one ranked name. 61, after Philip, tells you it was the 61 most common name in the historical record for that name. So Philip, we don't need a clarification. There's only going to be one Philip. You know who you're talking about. Bartholomew, not common, no clarification. James, number 11, common name. We're told it's the son of Alphaeus or the son of Zebedee. So common names, New Testament authors, tell us a clarification. Uncommon names, they don't. Once again, if you're a forger writing this hundreds of years later, you don't know that. You can't get that sort of information. And so people often mention these books called the Gnostic Gospels. Have you heard about the Gnostic Gospels? Things like the Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Thomas. And people, they're like, well, why were these books not included in the Bible? Maybe they give us some extra information. And if you go and do this same analysis of the names on the Gnostic Gospels, you find they're totally wrong. They put names into the story which had no record in the first century. They didn't get the ratios of the names correct. And that tells you that that's someone, something someone's written much longer after the time period, rather than what we see with the biblical accounts of the lives, is we see eyewitness testimony. We see the accounts of people who were genuinely there and genuinely telling us about what happened. Next slide. Now, it's possible you could have a book which isn't corrupted and which was genuinely written in the first century, but it could still be wrong, right? Like, I could set a story in Coventry and I could tell you amazing things about what happened, and I would be able to fill it with all the details, but it wouldn't make the story true. I could just be making it up, right? So that would be the third thing we want to find evidence for. Is it true? And so, if we look at some non-Christian historical sources, we can find some really strong evidence that it is. So there's a Jewish Roman historian called Josephus, and he's really interested in the history of the first century AD and BC. He still writes two very long histories filled with historical details over that time period. He mentions the same sort of big players which we get in the Bible. He meets people like Pontius Pilate, Herod the Great, Herod Agrippa. He tells us about their lives and the different things which they do. But he also tells us a story about James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ. And he tells about how James, the brother of Jesus, was killed by the religious leaders in Jerusalem. And he tells us about how then afterwards the people of Jerusalem rioted in protest, because James was known as such a man of prayer and such a man of God that it was unfair that he had been just killed in this way. And so that's really interesting to us for two things. But firstly, that James was known because his brother had claimed to be the Christ, claimed to be the Messiah, and that Josephus is writing at the end of the first century. So this claim that Jesus was the Messiah couldn't have come out later than the first century, otherwise Josephus wouldn't have known about it. The second thing we know is that James was respected. James wasn't known as a troublemaker who made up stories or who lied about things, but if that had been the case, for people in Jerusalem wouldn't have rioted. They rioted because James was notorious for his piety and for his godliness, that they trusted, even if they didn't agree with him, that he was sincere. Later on, in just the beginning of the second century, there's a Roman governor called Pliny writing in AD 112. So if you think about that, that's within 100 years of the life of Jesus, it's within 20 years of the final books of the New Testament being written. And he has a problem because lots of people are being accused of being Christians in his province. He says, that a multitude from every age, sex, class were being accused of being Christians. He writes to the Roman Emperor to get clarification on what he's to do with it. So within 20 years of the writing of the New Testament, the accounts are considered so accurate and reliable by the people who are there in the context, in the time period, who would have been able to witness and talk to the people who have witnessed the events of Jesus, that a multitude from every type of person are becoming a Christian, and that's causing civil disruption to the Roman Empire. If the accounts were false, if they were just made up, then why would a multitude of people believe that? If I was going to make up an imaginary story about what happened in Coventry, the last people to believe it would be the people who live in Coventry, right?
Yeah.
I could go to Paris and tell people about the amazing things that I've seen in Coventry, and I might be able to convince someone. But I wouldn't be able to convince people who live here, because you would be like, well, we know it didn't happen, right? Like, it would be impossible to make people believe that Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead in Jerusalem, in this area of the Middle East, if he hadn't actually done it. Because everyone would be like, well, we know. We saw the tomb, we know where he was buried, we knew Lazarus, we know he's dead. Unless it was actually credible. Unless the witnesses actually said, no, he really came back from the dead. If you go to the next slide. The final text I want to talk about is the Talmud, which is a collection of rabbinic sayings about Jesus. Not about Jesus, but a collection of rabbinic sayings. And there is one about Jesus, which says, the master said, Jesus of Nazareth, the Nazarene, practiced magic and deceived and led Israel astray. That the religious leaders in the Gospels and here, they don't claim that Jesus never did any miracles. That wouldn't have been credible because there were thousands of witnesses to what he did. They had to deal with the problem by claiming he did them by magic. But because the evidence was too strong for people living in that time period to believe anything else, that they needed another explanation. There you go, you can play with that. So I hope what I've tried to show you is we've got some really good evidence to be confident the Bible's not been corrupted, it was written in the first century, and that people genuinely believe that what it said was true, that we have a confidence that this is a true story which has been passed down to us. I hope that as you kind of become familiar with that evidence, that's going to help you as you talk and go out and meet people, because I can guarantee you'll get questions about Israel.